Welcome to Seeing the Full Picture, a podcast about systems thinking for health systems. This is a special podcast series from the Alliance for Health Policy and Systems Research. It was developed with the George Institute for Global Health.
Episode 2, Background to Systems Thinking. This episode considers how systems thinking tools, methods, and approaches have been used in different fields. We speak to two leaders in applying systems thinking to business and organizational issues. The discussion covers background to systems thinking, overcoming challenges, importance of building a foundation for change, notions of linear evaluation, some real-world failures and successes, and how current events demonstrate the need for systems thinking on a global scale.
I'm Devaki Nambiar, and I'm a health policy and systems researcher working at the George Institute based out of Delhi in India.
Hi, my name's Stephen Jan. I'm co-director of health system science at the George Institute for Global Health in Australia, and I'm also a health economist by training. Before we start this episode, my co-host Devaki and I will just reflect on a few key aspects.
I found the episode really fascinating. It was great to be able to have the opportunity to speak to David and Peter about some of the broader issues around systems thinking and how it's been applied outside the health sector.
The critical issue that David and Michael brought up of rigor, you know, how do we get at those? I really appreciated that they have struggled with that and have been working through that. Another highlight for me, Stephen, was when David brought up this idea of ruthless compassion. And I felt that sort of this idea of inclusivity in the way that we think as a way of thinking and of really trying to be open and just be very insistent on that is itself a form of rigor. So I found it quite liberating to think of it in those terms. Still thinking, though, how on a more granular level, and more specifically, we can apply that in health systems, but really fantastic food for thought.
Yeah, absolutely. The way they characterize health systems thinking is not just a science, but as an art. And the fact that, you know, things like intuition and understanding of relationships and interconnectedness is fantastic. But in some ways, also a bit scary for me. You know, we're taught to learn that randomized controlled trials are the gold standard and rigor comes from quantification and precision in measurement. And it really was quite an eye-opener to be sort of exposed to this broader level of thinking. And the fact that, you know, these are really ideas that have a lot of resonance in the health sector, and they're ideas that are really growing. And I'd be interested to see how many health people are familiar with the work of these guys and how much penetration some of these ideas will have in the health sphere in coming years.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining, and thank you to whoever is listening around the world who've got an interest in systems thinking. Today, we've got two very distinguished guests, David Peter Stroh and Michael Goodman, and they're both leaders in applying systems thinking to business and organizational issues. They're also conveners of AppliedSystemsThinking.com. David's also the author of a book called Systems Thinking for Social Change. I took a lot of interest in actually the last chapter of your book and sort of highlighting some of the implications that your work has for how you evaluate programs, because I'm sort of confident I can speak on behalf of Devaki as well that a lot of our work does revolve around program evaluation. Just going through your book and sort of highlighting some of the challenges of capturing impact of programs given some of the constraints that program deliverers are often under in terms of political timeframes and political cycle and, you know, showing results and those sorts of things. And it'll be great to be able to explore some of those issues in the talk today. So I'll kick off with the first question. How is systems thinking both an art and a science? And the reason why I wanted to ask that question is that I was struck when sort of reading the book and the way you present systems thinking as not just a set of tools, but I use the term as a way of being. And I just wanted to unpack that and how that sort of lines up with the sort of change in mindset that we as health researchers might need to undergo in order to adopt a genuine systems thinking approach.
I'm David, by the way, in terms of if anybody's going to be able to recognize voices as we go through this. I wrote a blog post before I published the book called Systems Thinking, It's Not Just What You Think. And we have found over the years that, yes, part of this work is cognitive and it involves principles and applications of tools. Stephen, you talked earlier about randomized control trials and, you know, what we can get at rationally. But there are also other dimensions to doing this work well. One is that there's an emotional component to it. People are very attached to what they believe and assume about what works and what doesn't work. And Mike once said, systems thinking is about making mental models explicit, helping people become aware of what they're actually thinking and what are the consequences of the thinking that they have. So drawing people out and challenging them around what are awfully deeply held beliefs and assumptions requires emotional intelligence, not just sharing ideas and data. A second thing is that there's a behavioral component to this. It involves learning how to bring groups of people together to not only have different conversations with each other, but actually learn how to think about the nature of their interdependencies across a more complex system. All of us are trained and usually funded to think about our part of the system and how to optimize our part of the system, not to think about what is the whole and what is best for the whole. And that to me then leads to the final one, which I think sometimes throws people or at least surprises people, which is there's a spiritual component to this work. All of us are connected. We learn this from our religious traditions, and it's true of systems thinking as well. And then the question becomes, well, how do we cultivate connections that are healthy, that are supportive of each of the other parts of the system, rather than often unintentionally make it harder for other people to succeed and hence for us to succeed? So to me, that's all embedded in this. And Mike, maybe you want to talk a little bit to the process of what we do, because the process is as important as the actual mechanics.
One of the things about the field, so let me step even way back, and Stephen and Devaki, cut me off if I'm off base here, but this idea of systems thinking is pretty broad. There's a lot of brands and versions and, you know, addition yeah. systems thinking. And it can be anywhere from the very analytical, using computer simulation, like in system dynamics, all the way through some of the things that David's been talking about, just the kind of a way of being, in a way of being together. So it's broad. And even within those categories, there's all sorts of other complexities. So the kind of systems thinking that David has captured in his book and the work that we have been doing together for the last umpteen decades, it really has its roots from the MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the founder of that field was a man who just died now 2 or 3 years ago, J.W. Forrester, who was an electrical engineer by background and then moved over to the Sloan School of Management at MIT and founded this new field called industrial dynamics and later became system dynamics. And to this day, there's a whole program there with people like John Sturman and others who lead the field. That part of the field is simulation-based, allowing people to actually enter into virtual worlds, mathematical worlds that can speak to them and try out experiments and see what they can learn. About, I would say about a couple decades ago, maybe even further back, a number of us who had been trained in that started up and really started focusing on what we're calling now systems thinking, which is taking the big ideas from the sort of more analytical quantitative side of the field and applying it much more broadly without all the necessary, the mathematics and the complexity, which is all very powerful, very useful, but for most of us is not accessible. And so that became the foundation of the field of systems thinking. And David's book really has captured the way at least David and I have evolved the practice of systems thinking. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a background. There's lots of systems thinking out there. And what we have, what David and I have particularly focused on is what David mentioned in terms of the kind of the intangibles around this, which is it's not so much about the maps or the models or the analysis that gets generated, but it's about what people get out of it and take out of it. You know, what's going to walk out of the room in their minds? You know, how has their thinking been influenced or changed? Mm-hmm. And so making our thinking visible and beginning to organize it in a visual way in which we can share it allows people to begin to maybe start to rethink or shift their minds. So we always talk about this work at its best as a team sport. It's not just coming up with a very clever analysis that some people may read and understand, follow, but it's about the experience of actually beginning to see how their well-intended actions and behaviors can have unintended or surprising consequences despite the intention.
Now, thanks for that. I just wanted at this point to slightly challenge you a bit on that. I mean, I think it's all so well and good for people like myself, Devaki, and the listeners on this to adopt the systems thinking. We're already on board. We're sort of most of the way there. What we need to do in our sort of day-to-day work is if we are to genuinely operationalize the systems thinking approach, we need to convince our stakeholders and our collaborators to also be systems thinkers. And I suppose one of the challenges from at least from my point of view is I work with clinicians, I work with policymakers. And they're very much constrained by their political or their practice sort of imperatives. And to argue the point that, well, we need to do this because everything's interconnected with everything else, to them, the argument I would get back to is, well, then that's a recipe for just doing nothing. To argue that everything's interconnected, that we've got to change the whole system in order to affect the change that we want. And in order to get things done, we need to pull out a bite-sized chunk of the world that we need to change and focus on that. So, I mean, how would you respond to that sort of pushback?
So one of the things that we do very early on with clients is we ask them to create what we call a focusing question. And a focusing question always starts with the word why. Why, often despite our best efforts, have we been unable to achieve a particular goal or solve a particular problem? When we do systems mapping with people, the goal of that mapping is to help them answer the question so that they can get unstuck, so that they can find the leverage in the situation that they have not been aware of, that they've often been working counterintuitively or against, really. So we always say the map is never intended to depict the system, because that is impossible, as you point out. It is unwieldy. It does lead to paralysis analysis and all of that. We want people to answer the question so that they can move forward. And so these maps are intended to answer a question, not to map a system.
And there's a challenge there. The very act of model building of any kind, and theory building, as you guys well know, is a matter of simplification. Is, you know, where are you going to draw your boundaries? What are you comfortable simplifying? What's in the bound, within the boundary? What's outside of the boundary? And, you know, are you sure about all that? And so it's very much an inquiry process. And as David said, that's attempting to ask the question, why? Before we go to what do we do? And our experience, and I think most people's experience in the real world, where pressures and constraints drive behavior, is that we spend very little time on the why and a lot more time, probably way more time on the how do we fix it before we even understand what it is. So we like to use the analogy of the medical model, which is before you start doing surgery, you may want to do a little diagnosis. because you may find out you don't need a new surgery. So that's all we're advocating for, is before we jump in to try to fix this thing, do we really understand what the disease is that we're dealing with and what's required? And here are some tools that can help.
I think that's a great point, Michael. And I think one of the challenges, I think the broader issue that many of us in health systems work have been frustrated with is the idea of sort of solutionism and sort of, you know, here's a solution. Let's articulate a, you know, and so it's a backwards way of ensuring failure, frankly. One of the things that struck me in your earlier explanation was the sort of aspects that even David brought up. It occurs to me that systems thinking is a kind of rigor in itself, rigor in terms of being reflexive, being transparent, being generous in terms of convening power and accommodating views, being tolerant of those, and also compassionate, as you were saying. So to me, that requires a lot of rigor to get all of that done, in addition to your the aspects of your discipline that pertain to rigor. But turning to the discipline of system science itself, how is rigor sort of achieved disciplinarily? Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the field is pretty broad. You know, it's all over the world. It's been around, certainly as an academic discipline, for decades. Anyway, in there is, and over time, there has been criteria developed by which you begin to validate models, validate parameters. So the benefit of having mathematical quantitative models, you can do even traditional statistic regression. You can do all sorts of tests that you guys would all be familiar with. When you move into the domain of systems thinking, and which is far more qualitative, then you need, there's a different set of tools. And unfortunately, you don't have the depth of data usually that you'd like to have, or that you might have when you have a more traditional simulation model. For that reason, and this is something that David and I have struggled with for most of our professional careers, how do you bring real rigor to this process, especially when we're talking about intangible things like mindsets and mental models of things that we've mentioned? And for that reason, we focus a lot on the process of how you go about constructing these. And we actually have a 4-stage process that we've evolved that is the backbone of David's book.
I think that one of the things we've learned is, because this is a process, you need to actually look for and evaluate for different benchmarks at different stages in the process. So initially, to us, the most important thing to do is to build a foundation for change. And that foundation usually involves engaging stakeholders who often have not been connecting with each other, or if they've been connecting with each other, it's primarily to try to get more resources for what they are already doing, and beginning to see if we can shift their orientation to one where they're interested and committed to optimizing the whole instead of just optimizing their parts. And that is something that is progressive, but it starts with shared visioning, with developing skills for productive conversations, understanding some basics about how systems behave and evolve. And once those new relationships are formed and people begin to think about their interdependencies in different ways, and very critically to think about their responsibility, not just for the solution, but their responsibility for the problem, because there is an enormous power in recognizing one's responsibility for the problem, because ultimately all of the stakeholders are part of the system. It's not the system is out there somewhere and they're trying to tinker with something that's beyond them. They're actually part of it. And ultimately, the greatest leverage they have is first in reflecting on their own intentions, their own thinking, and their own behavior. So with all of those foundational pieces in place, which can take a while, one can then subsequently, with the taking into account the necessary delays in the system, one can begin to look for outcomes. And then even as one looks for outcomes, one has to recognize that what works for a period of time is not necessarily always going to work. There are limits to any particular type of growth engine in a system. Conditions change. And so a commitment to continuous learning is as important to the process as building a strong foundation for change in the first place. So measuring outcomes, which is, of course, what policymakers are interested in, is certainly part of it. But unless one measures how strong the foundation is for change among the diverse stakeholders on the front end, and how much of a learning system there is that is built in place to allow for continuous learning, whatever happens in that middle phase of improved outcomes may or may not ever sustain itself.
So for a system change agent, David and Michael, what then is demanded of them? What are the competencies and capabilities that they need to have in order to be an agent for this kind of thinking or a catalyst for this kind of thinking and change?
I think a lot of what we're pointing to and actually how we go about our work is the idea of transferring capacity into the people involved in the system as much as possible. So it is rare for David and I to come in and do an analysis as external consultants for different clients. And we certainly have touched the public health world and the healthcare world. What really we think sticks and matters, and we know because we've seen it, is when individuals and hopefully more than just a few, but when groups within those organizations, within the system, actually learn and make this part of who they are and how they think and how they approach issues. So we talk a lot about capacity building in our work. And for us, it's being exposed to the tools, learning this, you know, as we would all want to do initially. Learning the tools is one thing. Actually having the experience of applying the tools, working with real clients or real situations in a team setting, at learning as you're going along, reflecting and inquiring, that for us is what it takes. It's not something that's done outside. It's something that happens. It's an inside out job for people to manifest this and to apply it into the real world. I hope that answers the question.
I appreciate the emphasis on capacity building. I had another thought in mind. But just building on the capacity building piece, we've developed capacity in systems thinking with leadership development programs for environmental public health fellows across the country. So there's leadership development within fellowship types of programs for systems thinking and also within individual organizations. So, for example, with one of the largest global environmental nonprofits, they've done capacity building, which combines the capacity building, learning the principles and tools, with project work, their own action learning projects, some of which are internal, designed to improve how they manage themselves within their global organization, which is in actually functioning in 79 different countries around the world. And then the second is improving their ability to do projects with the communities that they impact in the different countries and regions where they operate. So both internally focused projects and externally focused projects. So sometimes capacity building can be in the foreground. Sometimes it has to be more in the background. So, for example, we're asked to, I was involved in a project to work with a coalition in a Western U.S. state to help them prevent wildfires, which, as you may be reading, is a serious problem in the West. And there, they weren't interested in learning about systems thinking necessarily or becoming systems thinkers. They were concerned about wildfires in that state, and that was it. So there, the work is more of a consulting project, more of a joint problem-solving project with them, but with coalition building being the key. And a certain amount of just-in-time education needed to take place in order for them to constructively be involved in the analytic and strategic planning applications of the tools.
Hopefully we start switching on light bulbs.
Last thing I wanted to say was just, I think there's an orientation for a facilitator here, part of which to me is embodied in the American term tough love, or the Buddhist idea of ruthless compassion, that we both really need to appreciate why people, why they do what they do, usually with the best of intentions, really be compassionate about the different points of view that they have and why they do what they do, and challenge them. Challenge them to see that any one stakeholder is only going to be able to see part of the system, not the interdependencies that are ultimately hurting them. And along with that, to help them see how they're part of the problem, albeit unintentionally, not just part of the solution. And holding both of those, compassion and toughness and challenge in the work.
Yeah. Look, I think many of the listeners, as well as Devaki and myself, have a strong interest in the evaluative side of the work that comes with systems thinking. And one of the constraints, I suppose, that we operate within in the health area is, we talked about this before we started the podcast, was the tyranny of randomized controlled trial and this obsession when evaluating programs with things like bias and confounding. And to me, what the systems thinking approach to evaluation suggests is a much more participatory approach to evaluation. And I just wonder whether the two paradigms are just so far apart that they're not really compatible, or do you see the role for formal, I suppose, quantitative evaluative methods such as randomized controlled trials as tools that could be used to evaluate systems level intervention?
So I believe, Stephen, I mentioned a few minutes ago in one of my earlier answers about, you know, needing to think about evaluation, at least with respect to how well the process is being implemented, as one that requires looking for different criteria at different stages. Foundation building should not be taken lightly. There's a temptation to think, if you're a policymaker, that all we need to do is change policy. Or if you are doing a randomized control, all you need to do is determine the right technical solution to a particular water problem or something like that. And of course, out in the real world, we know that policies in and of themselves don't necessarily change anything. We know that even if we have the most brilliant technical solutions, people won't necessarily buy into it for all sorts of reasons. There might be some losers as well as there are winners. The ultimate beneficiaries may not go along with it or have the skills to really adopt it. So we know that the world is much messier than what we can control through a randomized solution. So we need to be looking at evaluating stages in a change process, not just in a technical solution. Certainly, randomized control studies are the gold standard for technical problems with technical solutions. And I think remarkable progress has been made by, for example, the Poverty Lab at MIT, by the Gates Foundation, and some of the healthcare work that they do around the world, which is, of course, very data driven. So I think really there's a both and here, not an either or.
It'd be a fantastic conversation. I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening to this would love to sort of follow up with you about ideas for how we can integrate some of that thinking into the work we do, particularly around evaluation, because to me, that's a real missing part of the jigsaw here.
Yes, and I would also add, you know, one of the challenges is evaluating the difference between the short-term impacts a change and the long-term impacts of the same change. We show a wonderful video called Waters of Iolé, which was based on drilling wells in villages for fresh water in Togo, West Africa in the 1980s. The goal being to bring potable water into the villages instead of having them walk many, many miles a day to an ultimately polluted water source, but the only one they had, and bring it back to the village and being dependent on that polluted source. So they came up with this idea of very simple water wells that could be drilled in villages. The villagers were thrilled. Everything worked. The engineers were so proud of their work, and they measured their success based on the wells initially drawing water, on how efficiently they could drill wells. So they got up to being able to do one or two a day, and they were just excited.
Six a day.
Okay, thank you. Then 2 years later, most of those pumps lay unused in the village. And they lay unused because no one had ever thought, who is going to maintain the pumps? The villagers assumed, well, the government installed the pumps, therefore the government will maintain the pumps. The government assumed, well, we gave the villagers the well. Of course, they're going to maintain their own well. But the villagers didn't have the capacity to collect the money or manage the money required. They didn't have the technical knowledge to know when something broke, what to do about it. And this, in this simple video, which is 30 minutes, the first 15 minutes is all about getting more and more efficient at a solution that worked for up to 2 years and then entirely stopped working. Versus the second half of that 30-minute video, it's a very simple, great teaching tool. You see the engineers talking with the villagers about why the pumps are no longer being used and discovering that they actually need to help the villagers build the internal infrastructure to maintain the wells. And once they help the villagers build that internal infrastructure, the villagers maintain the wells. But that's a great example of short-term versus long-term impact.
Well, and in terms of evaluation, the measures by the funders was the number of wells drilled. And so, you know, you can see the whole metric system was a technical focus on getting more and more wells to places that needed them, and very proudly, as David mentioned, really getting very good at that. And it wasn't about ultimately the ability for the village, even though the goal was to get potable water to the village, it was whether it was sustainable. That had been missed in the evaluation, in the metric.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mike, because the other thing it prompts me to point to is applying these tools of understanding causal feedback and how systems behave and evolve in circular ways to strategic planning and to the development of what I call in my book a systemic theory of change, one that actually takes into account how you would integrate different leverage points sequentially over time. And recognizing that each leverage point may have its own metric associated with it, and there are natural sequences. So we need to measure the success of A before we measure the success of B, and there may need to be a certain time delay before we're likely to see the B kick in. So evaluation needs to take place against an explicit theory of change. And ideally for us, that theory of change is not linear, but circular, because systems behave and evolve in circular ways.
Absolutely. That's a good point. I think particularly when you look at water, the realm of water and sanitation, you see this all around. And an analog to what you have been talking about is open defecation in India, and the thrust and emphasis put on infrastructure and just building toilets everywhere, right? And the issue of sanitation, defecation, All of these are linked to broader societal issues having to do with caste, who's cleaning these toilets, who's building them, who's using them. And I think this idea of thinking circularly is gaining traction. So I will say that. In fact, the Lancet Commission on Planetary Health, for instance, uses the European Commission's idea of a circular economy. So I guess the question then is systems thinking taking? Is it spreading? Has it been growing in the years of your experience with it?
So the field, as I mentioned in my kind of quick history, goes back to the 50s. And there it was very much model-based and simulation-based. And I, frankly, it got some attention. Probably the most attention was early work of Jay Forrester called Urban Dynamics, which was the how urban centers grow, mature, and then decline. And that can be expected of just about every urban center. And what are the policies that will make a difference in terms of turning around decaying cities? So this is work back in the near the war on poverty days in this country. But later, probably the thing that got most people's attention was a book called Limits to Growth, which came out, I think, in the early 70s. That got global attention because it took a systemic look at at climate change, at degradation of the planet, you know, that we cannot continue to outgrow our capacity to survive and thrive. And this was 40 years before the current environmental movement. And it raised a lot of the same questions, like how do we sustain this? It's not sustainable. And so it took a systemic look at those. That got a lot of play. I think since then, there's been some very interesting applications and interest shown. And you're seeing systems thinking in more and more graduate programs, I think sometimes undergrad. So it's spreading there, but I would say, frankly, not nearly enough and not nearly as extensively as we would have hoped now that we're well over 50 or 60 years in this. Some of the most current ones that are getting a lot of attention, there's some work done by colleagues of ours from Climate Interactive, and they have created simulations, almost a newer or modern version of the Limits to Growth work, but it intended to be used for climate action. And what has been really notable about it, which we're all proud of, is the fact that at least in the U.S., a lot of senators, a lot of representatives, a lot of Al Gore-type people have been exposed to this simulator or systems thinking, been used by the UN in the climate discussions or meetings, the Chinese government. So it's gotten a lot of attention, and it's very much brings systems thinking to a larger set of policymakers. It takes a systems view. Basically, it's sitting right in front of them in a laptop. So those sorts of things, I think, are getting traction. But to answer your question, I think simply is it is growing, it continues to grow, but not nearly enough.
One of the things that Jay Forrester did is recognize that it's very hard to retrain people who, like ourselves, were in an education system where you're told to break things into parts and to get to know one part really, really well, and then improve that part. And to think, by contrast, in terms of wholes and understanding wholes and improving wholes goes against our educational background. It goes against our metrics. It goes against our funding streams. It goes against our management structures, as compelling as it is. And so what he did is he funded a major investment in K-12 schools to teach systems thinking to young people so that they get a fresh start in how to understand the world. And yes, we've certainly made progress with adults. We will continue to do that. But this is also a generational and multi-generational challenge.
In fact, there's a couple of schools that have as their major focus is systems thinking. And then they kids learn the other stuff, the traditional fragmented stuff, and how it fits into the systems view. So they've kind of reversed the normal process, which was learn pieces and then hopefully later put it together. They start with how do things work and then where do these various disciplines play in?
Thanks, Michael and Dave. That's been fantastic, really enlightening. And I'm sure to the listeners, you've opened up new ideas and introduced concepts that people will no doubt be thinking about applying in their day-to-day work.
And I think one of the things that struck me is, you know, people are quite happy to think about their work in the context of a system, but we are parts of multiple systems, aren't we? So I was just thinking, you know, where I'm doing this thing as a professional and then I have my system as a parent. I'm interested in some quick thoughts from you on what the pandemic has thrown up in terms of these multiple systems, you know, that have to be thought through in a larger system of systems framework. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Early on in the pandemic, a lot of us in the system dynamics world recognized that this was a known process, that there's a lot known about epidemics and their trajectory and even, you know, where some of the leverage points are. And so a lot of us jumped in to build system dynamics models of the and take on then, this is some months ago, about how do you flatten the curve? I was one who jumped in and did my little model, but I in doing a little bit of literature search, this was back, I think about 4 or 5 months ago, I looked at the Lancet eClinic, eClinic Medicine, I guess is their online publication. And there was an article, it's called The Systems Approach to Preventing and Responding to COVID-19, which is a system analysis. There's a lot here. And I was early on in the COVID, in the epidemic, again, here, I can't speak for outside of the US, but there was lots of talk about, you know, exponential growth and flattening the curve and the models projecting this and the models projecting that. And I was going, systems thinking, we're doing it. Here it is, you know, without all the jargon, but this is exactly what the work's about. We have these trends and patterns, and we have models, and we can try out things, what if experiments to see what might happen. And so I was very gratified, you know, despite the fact that the horror of this whole thing, that this sort of brought into the spotlight, public spotlight, many of the concepts that David and I and the community who does this work have been working on for decades.
Thank you. David, anything to add there in terms of pandemic lessons and reflections?
Well, I think one point again is the power of prevention. A pound of prevention worth an ounce of cure, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. and so that's a systems lesson that applies in so many different places. The only other thought that came to mind is people in healthcare, I think, learn a lot about the system of the human body. And they may not recognize some of the commonalities between the dynamics in a body and the dynamics in a social system. By contrast, I did a lot of work with engineers around systems thinking. And as Mike said, Jay Forrester began as an electrical engineer. The idea of feedback, of time delay, a lot of these ideas engineers are very familiar with. And I would expect that healthcare professionals are very familiar with too. What they don't recognize is that the same mindset and the same language can be applied and extended into understanding the social systems that are so frustrating for them. It's another type of living system.
Yes, and with predictable, just like with homeostasis, just like with our bodies and with microbiology and even with economics, there are classic structures that are likely to produce certain kinds of outcomes. So the dynamics that we might understand in one field could be applied to the other. What we do is take the things we know about, like bodies and cells and multiplication and delays, and apply them to that kind of intermediate world of the human world that we inhabit. And there are predictable traps and predictable dynamics that can be avoided and can be dealt with. And a lot of this work is extending that what we know often in the sciences and taking it to the next level, different level.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. We really appreciate the time you've given us.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for listening. We hope this episode has inspired you to consider the relevance of systems thinking approaches in your work. Make sure you subscribe to Seeing the Full Picture so that you don't miss an episode. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.